everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's November 2024, and you're listening to episode 418, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the classic C.S. Lewis space trilogy novels. Today's guest is Cole Burgett, who is a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary and the Moody Bible Institute. He teaches systematic theology and Bible exposition classes and writes extensively about theology and popular culture. Cole has written an exclusive online feature article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called Science, Spirituality, and C.S. Lewis, an analysis of the space trilogy. You can read it for free at equip.org. That's equip.org. Cole, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
Always good to be here. Thank you.
So today we're covering some maybe lesser known works to our contemporary readers that the Christian author C.S. Lewis has written. Now, C.S. Lewis is best known for probably his classic work, Mere Christianity, and also the children's fantasy series, The Chronicles of Narnia, because those are taught in school, even public school. But this is a trilogy of three science fiction novels that he wrote, and they are Out of the Silent Planet, Perelandra, and That Hideous Strength. And the first book was written more than 80 years ago. So I guess my question to you to start this discussion of this trilogy is, why would Christians or should Christians read books that were written almost 80 years ago? I mean, how is it relevant for us in 2024?
Yeah, so Christians might care about the space trilogy because at its core, it's not just science fiction. It's packed with themes of faith, morality, the nature of good and evil. Lewis, as is sort of well known, was a Christian himself, and his beliefs naturally shaped the way he wrote. So for people of faith, these books offer an adventure through space, but they also explore questions that are sort of central to Christianity as a whole. So just by way of example, in Out of the Silent Planet, and we'll talk more about this, Lewis imagines other worlds where sin hasn't corrupted everything, which sort of invites the reader to think about what it means to live in a world that is broken. Very similarly in Perelandra, there's this retelling of the Eden story, but this time with the possibility of resisting temptation. It's like Lewis is asking, what if things could go differently? Well, that's a big deal for Christians, because it ties back into ideas about redemption, that sort of thing. So while the trilogy certainly works as sci-fi, it also speaks to those deeper ideas or themes, to say it that way, that Christians are often thinking about on a Sunday morning or something like that. It's Lewis's way of wrapping theological ideas in a very fun, very imaginative package, which is why these are books that still resonate with a lot of believers today. So that's just kind of a general overview of why Christians may want to revisit this series after so long.
So we recently talked about the second season of The Rings of Power, which is based on Tolkien's work. So Lewis and Tolkien were friends, and they decided to write about myth and science fiction and time travel separately. But how does his C.S. Lewis mythological storytelling really is a tool or a springboard, or what he's really trying to say at a deeper level is really about Christian apologetics?
Yeah, Lewis seemed to understand something very key about people, and that something makes his storytelling quite powerful. He knew that people often respond more openly to stories than to arguments. Now, we're talking about this in the context of Christian apologetics. So when someone tries to reason their way to faith, they can hit roadblocks, mental objections, doubts, that kind of a thing. And I mean, this is what Christian apologetics is, right? It's sort of figuring out where the roadblocks are, figuring out where the mental objections are, defending, in a sense, the faith, accounting for those roadblocks, that sort of thing. And there are all these different approaches to Christian apologetics, whether it's classical apologetics and evidentialism, whether it's presuppositional apologetics, fideism, that kind of a thing. There are all these different discussions and ways of doing apologetics. But what Lewis understood is that a good story, especially a myth, has a way of very naturally bypassing those intellectual defenses. Because what it does is it reaches the imagination directly, making people feel the truth before they start trying to dissect it. And this has been written about at length. We've talked a lot about this in different episodes of this podcast. But take, just by way of example, to sort of illustrate the point, take the Chronicles of Narnia. A child reading about Aslan's sacrifice might not consciously make the intellectual connection, oh, this is a parallel to the atonement of Christ. But emotionally, they experience the, let's call it, the weight of sacrifice and the weight of redemption in that story about Aslan. In the same way, the Space Trilogy allows readers to experience the weight of sin and grace and redemption, but in a way that feels very natural and engaging. When Ransom's the protagonist of a couple of these books, when Ransom encounters beings on this planet Malachandra who never fell into sin, it forces the reader, even if they're not consciously aware of it, to begin reframing their understanding of what it means to live in a broken world. And what it means to live in harmony with or separated from God. What's remarkable is how Lewis uses the structure of myth to awaken that longing, what Lewis called sinsucht, or the inconsolable longing for something beyond this world. When I was writing about this, in my undergrad, I did an undergrad thesis on a very similar subject, and it was all sort of tied in together. It is almost as if humans have this inbuilt genetic memory of Eden, a time before, that pushes us, inches us toward something greater than just what's in front of us. Lewis believed that all myths, pagan or otherwise, point in some way toward the ultimate truth of the gospel. This very concept is what converted him. He was sort of legendarily an atheist before he met J.R.R. Tolkien and another fellow by the name of Hugo Dyson. And Lewis and Tolkien and Dyson would have these walks and conversations about these topics. And Lewis, what's fascinating is that even though Lewis was an atheist, he loved mythological stories. He loved pagan myths, the Norse myths, that kind of a thing. And his mental roadblock was thinking that if I convert to Christianity, well, I can't read any more of these stories. You know, I have to give up the things that I enjoy, not in any sort of perverse way, but just that I like. I like these stories. I don't have to give all of this up. And the profound revelation that Tolkien and Dyson communicated to him was that, no, 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 no. by converting, by stepping into Christianity, it recolors what those stories are doing and points you to what Lewis would eventually call the capital T, capital M, true myth. Christianity has, the story of the Bible has these mythic ideas in it, but it's the myth that occurs in space, time, and history. So readers might not be ready to hear a sermon, as Lewis, at a point in his life, was very much sort of not ready to hear a sermon. But he can begin to experience, just as Lewis did through stories, the sense that the Christian narrative fulfills the deepest longings expressed in every myth humanity has ever told. Period. Full stop. And so Lewis's stories awaken a sense of wonder, which, by the way, is often missing in modern apologetics. Some could say that this is the Achilles heel of modern apologetics, because we are still very modern in our thinking. We want evidence. We want hard facts. We want empiricism, all the while stripping any sense of wonder away from the Christian experience. Many apologetic works, and rightly so, different apologetic methods and different approaches to apologetics all have a particular place in time, space, and history. I'm not taking shots at, you know, Lee Strobel here. Lee Strobel's books work and are important for the audiences that they work and are important for, but I know people who could read it, blink, and go, that did nothing for me, still don't buy it. Many apologetic works focus heavily on evidence and logic and reason, and while those things are essential, they sometimes miss the emotional and imaginative dimension of faith, which is absolutely critical. Absolutely critical. Lewis's mythological storytelling reminds us that Christianity isn't just a set of propositions to be believed, but it is a story, one that we participate in, one that is to be lived. As I'm so fond of telling my students, the best way to prepare you to read the Bible is not to give you a commentary, which is just, you know, Joe Bob's thoughts on what Paul might be talking about. It's not to give you a video of a pastor for you to go watch him, you know, tear through a section of text, and that's if he's even preaching expositionally. No, go pick up a storybook, learn how plot, characters, dialogue, and narrative work, then come to the Bible, which, by the way, is 50% narrative literature. And the other 50% deals with the 50% that is narrative literature. It deals with what happens and deals with the ramifications of what happens in the percent that is narrative literature. It's a story that we have to find ourselves in. And that story resonates with us, even if we don't immediately recognize its source. This is why there is a very, if you can call it, tragic irony to the fact that there are so many out there in the world today who couldn't give a rip about Jesus, and yet they turn up to every superhero movie that comes out. They worship at the altar of the superhero, which is a very mythic concept. It's a very mythic kind of story. And there is a sort of tragic irony there. That again, I sort of characterize as this, it's this inbuilt sort of genetic, spiritual genetic memory, if that's what you want to call it, of Eden, of something that pushes us just a little bit beyond the mundane. So this is why his stories still draw readers today. They speak to a longing that only the true myth can satisfy.
The first book in the space trilogy is Out of the Silent Planet, and that one was published in 1938, which is a long time ago. And the main protagonist character is Dr. Elwin Ransom, who's a professor of philology at Cambridge. And then he has a nemesis, Dr. Weston, who is a physicist who is against the liberal arts and favors science and reason, etc., which is really interesting because it's similar to how culture looks at things today. Science is truth, and anything that is not science is questionable. So in this book, Lewis describes Earth as Tholkandra, aka the silent planet, and it's a world that has fallen under the influence of a malevolent being. So what theological message do you think that C.S. Lewis conveys by presenting Earth as estranged from the divine order, you know, compared to the rest of the universe? And how does this compare to Scripture's perspective on spiritual warfare and demonic forces?
So Tholkandra, or the silent planet, this is one of Lewis's most haunting images. What Lewis is doing here is showing that Earth's fall into sin isn't just a local problem. It's cosmic in scale. The silence of Tholkandra, and just so that people have context for this, the reason it's called the silent planet, it's a term that is given to the planet by all the other beings of the cosmos. Tholkandra, or what we call Earth, is sort of designated the silent planet. It's cut off. So the silence of Tholkandra reflects the way that humanity's rebellion against God has isolated it, not only from God, but from the rest of creation as well. The idea that Earth is cut off taps into this concept of separation, the effects of sin, like how sin disrupts one's relationship with God in Genesis chapter 3. But Lewis isn't just focusing on individual sin, and this is critical. He's also showing that humanity's spiritual rebellion has wider consequences. So in the trilogy, each planet is sort of under the care of this being called an Oyarsa, or a kind of angelic being. Mollachandra, Mars, Paralandra, Venus remain, let's say, in harmony with the divine order, because their Oyarsas are loyal to Maladil. Maladil is the god figure of the story. They're their term for this being. But Earth's Oyarsa has become, in Lewis's language, bent, a clear reference to Satan. This bent Oyarsa leads Earth into darkness and chaos, aligning with the Bible's depiction of Satan as a deceiver, and according to John 12, the ruler of this world. So Lewis's portrayal of Earth as silent fits perfectly with the biblical understanding of spiritual warfare. Earth is trapped under the dominion of this malevolent force, and it takes divine intervention, Christ's incarnation and sacrifice, to break that silence and restore the relationship between humanity and God. Now, in my own dealings with the Space Trilogy, I have found that there are many Christians who react to those ideas. And this, I think, is largely due to a lack of understanding the broader historical and cultural context in which the Old Testament in particular is written. So before we react to the idea that, oh, Satan ruling the world, oh, what is this? We have to understand how this fits within the broader context of ancient Near Eastern thought. In the ancient Near Eastern idea, there was a concept that in recent years has become more and more popular, due largely in part to the writings of the late Dr. Michael Heiser, the idea of what is sometimes called the Divine Council. Now, this idea of the Divine Council is where gods, lowercase g with an s on the end, as uncomfortable as that makes us, gods ruled in a cosmic hierarchy with a chief deity presiding over lesser divine beings. And we all know from our basic Bible classes and basic church teachings that Christianity is a, what we say, monotheistic religion. And so when we hear this and we see that lowercase g with the s on the end, we start to, something inside of us flares up and we go, whoa, wait a minute, monotheism. Okay. If your monotheism is suggesting that nowhere in the Bible is there room allowed for other spiritual beings, you're probably going to run into trouble with a passage like Psalm 82, where God, capital G, Elohim, is said to stand in the divine assembly among the other Elohim, lowercase g, s on the end. Divine beings or rulers. God stands among the gods. Some of these beings are seen as benevolent, while others become rebellious, turning into, quote, rulers or powers that are said to influence the nations and oppose God's will. That's Deuteronomy 32, 8, and 9. The Bible also, in the, oh, no, remember, we're talking Old Testament here, also refers to shading, Deuteronomy 32, often translated as, quote, demons or false gods, implying spiritual beings who mislead humanity. In other words, when the Old Testament writers looked out at the other nations surrounding Israel, they didn't just see people. They saw what in the New Testament Paul is going to characterize as the rulers of this age, the principalities and powers, 1 Corinthians 2, Ephesians chapter 6. The biblical narrative suggests, just as Psalm 82 prophesies, that God tolerates their authority for a time, but ultimately will judge and overthrow them. Psalm 82 says to them, it's Yahweh talking to them, you are gods, lowercase g, s on the end, but you will die like men. So in this way, the biblical story acknowledges a very complex spiritual world where divine beings, once part of God's counsel, became corrupted, rebelled against him, and now stand in opposition to him. And not only that, but they are rulers. They rule. It's almost as if you're following the biblical narrative, the chief rebel, the first rebel, this entity we call the devil, he leaves and he takes humanity with him. I'm going out the door. And he takes God's prized possession, his great creation. These people who are said to rule in Eden, who are representing God through their rule. And they walk out the door hand in hand. Well, then you get to Genesis 4, 5, 6. And we start to see these very strange stories about these other sons of God, these other entities that see the chief rebel go out the door and they decide they want a piece of the pie too. Then they start rebelling. Deuteronomy 32 is going to characterize the Tower of Babel as the great zenith of the human and spiritual rebellion, where human forces and these rogue agents, if you want to call them that, these rogue agents of the divine council walk out the door hand in hand. And the Tower of Babel is the great zenith of that rebellion, where Yahweh scatters the nations in accordance with the number of the Elohim, in accordance with the number of these lowercase gs on the end gods. And this doesn't step on the toes of monotheism, because what we mean when we say we're monotheists is that we worship one God. We follow one God. Hear, O Israel, Lord your God is one, the Shema. There's one. What that doesn't mean is that the Bible does not have categories for other spiritual entities that are in fact ruling and are in opposition to that one. Because that is absolutely in the text, not just in the Old Testament, but it is the Old Testament categories that Paul is going to deal with in, because he was a Jewish guy who knew the law and knew the Old Testament. He's going to pull that theology forward when he writes his letters in the New Testament and make reference to it. So the silence of earth in Lewis's work echoes Paul's teaching in Ephesians 6:12. Our battle isn't against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, the authorities, the powers of the world. For Lewis, earth's isolation is this symptom of a larger spiritual conflict. It's a cosmic rebellion that involves not just humans, but spiritual beings in both loyalty and in opposition to capital G God. And in that silence, we see not just the loneliness of that fallen world, but the need, the desperate need, one could even say, for redemption. So we could spend, you know, a whole other episode just on the ancient Near Eastern stuff, but that's sort of where Lewis is going in his work, and how, you know, I don't think Christians should necessarily just write off, oh, you know, well, that's just a nifty idea, Lewis. The Bible doesn't have any categories for that kind of stuff. Not quite.
As I've mentioned earlier this year, it's our 8th year of podcasting. We've been podcasting since 2016, and we are over 400 episodes. That is a huge back catalog to explore. And not only that, with every single episode, you will find an article that's attached to the episode that I interview its author on these Postmodern Realities conversations. And I hope you enjoy looking back at all the different subjects that we covered. One of the things that we do quite regularly is do some cultural apologetics. So we try to be up on the latest hot television series and films and even classics like the C.S. Lewis Space Trilogy that we're talking about today, because all of these things, all of these stories are really great ways to actually engage people in Christian apologetics through story, because as we are talking about on this podcast, everyone enjoys stories. Everyone enjoys the ideas of superheroes or things that are larger than themselves. So there's so much to mine for the Christian apologist. And for all these 400 episodes, they've been completely free. There is no paywall at our website. There's nothing like that. We no longer have a subscription magazine. We have an online magazine with new articles every week, and it's always free. So we ask that you help us out by just getting the word out. So tell a friend, rate and review, particularly on Apple Podcasts, and we are grateful for your partnership. And you might want to give us a tip. We don't have subscriptions anymore, as I've said, but we still do pay our authors because we believe all the research and in-depth writing that they do on these subjects is definitely worth their remuneration. So if you feel so led, please give us a tip at our website, equip.org. And you can do that by clicking on Journal at the top of the page, then Postmodern Realities, and then at any one of the landing pages, you will find a link to give us a tip. And literally 100% of our budget is from partners like you, people who appreciate that the work that we do here at the Christian Research Journal. So thank you for your partnership. And we are grateful for you listening and telling a friend. So now back to my conversation about C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy with Cole Burgett.
So he's doing some world building in this trilogy. And of course, based on the assumption that the Bible's story is fundamentally true, even for aliens. And we do have an article. We've done a lot on ancient aliens and aliens, and would the gospel still be valid if there were aliens? So we will link that in the show notes. But how does this world building shape the narrative? And what are the both, I'd say, advantages and challenges of, you know, creating a science fiction universe on explicitly Christian foundations? I mean, he did that in his fantasy work for Narnia, but how's it different? He's writing to adults here.
Yeah. What sort of makes the space trilogy unique in the genre of science fiction as a whole is that it's not just science fiction with a few Christian ideas tacked on. It's a fully realized fictional universe built on the assumption that the biblical narrative is true for all beings everywhere. Lewis treats Christian theology not as something that applies only to Earth, but as a cosmic reality that governs all of creation. I mean, it's fascinating. It's a radical idea, really, especially in the context of the genre, where alien cultures are so often portrayed as independent from human religion. What Lewis does incredibly well here is explore the theological implications of a universe where not every being has experienced the fall. On Malachandra, for example, the creatures have no need for redemption because they've never sinned. They live in harmony with Maladil's will, which gives the reader a glimpse of what human life might have been like without the fall, something that's hinted at in Genesis, but isn't always explored in traditional theology. It's considered speculative theology. Meanwhile, on Paralandra, we see a version of the Eden story in real time, with Ransom, or the protagonist, playing the role of the agent trying to prevent a second fall. The advantage of this approach is that it forces readers to see the biblical story in a new light. It's one thing to hear a pastor say that sin disrupted our relationship with God. It's another to experience that disruption through the narrative of a silent planet, cut off from its creator. That emotional and imaginative engagement can sort of lead readers somewhat unsuspectingly into the gospel. And of course, that challenge is that this approach assumes a certain familiarity with Christian ideas. If a reader comes to the trilogy without any background in Christianity, they might miss some of the connections Lewis is making, but even then, the stories still resonate on a symbolic level. The themes of sacrifice, redemption, cosmic struggle, all that stuff, they're universal. And they invite the reader to begin wrestling with questions that ultimately will point them to Christ. That's the great conviction of Christianity, the lofty assertions about reality and the way things are that Christianity makes. If those are in fact true, then readers wrestling with these questions should ultimately point them toward Christ.
So who is Charles Williams, and what was his influence in the novel, The Hideous Strength? And why do you think his work resonated with Lewis, even when maybe Tolkien didn't really resonate with Charles Williams' work? And how is his work a use of Arthurian mythology? And is that present in this story's apologetic narrative?
Yeah. So the, if I'm not mistaken, the article sort of goes into to some of this. There's a reason this question is being asked, so the listeners know, like, where is this coming from? What about Charles Williams, that kind of
thing? Yeah, you'll need to. And also, we always link the article in the show notes for wherever you're getting your podcasts, or on YouTube, so you can, you know, read the article after you listen to this.
Yeah, Melanie's making a connection here. That's the idea. She's connecting this Charles Williams to this, and there's a reason for that. Very loosely, I'll talk about this. Charles Williams, one of my absolute favorite writers, simply because he's so weird and wonderful. And I did a lot of work with Charles Williams in grad school. Charles Williams was a British writer, theologian, a member of the Inklings. For those of you who don't know, the Inklings was a literary group that included C.S. Lewis and Tolkien. Williams was born in I think it was 1886, and he worked most of his life at Oxford University Press. He gained quite the reputation there as an editor and scholar. He had a hand in Dante, in having Dante's works translated, that sort of thing. He loved the Divine Comedy, that sort of thing. Williams' writing spanned a lot of genres. He wrote poetry, he wrote theology, he wrote fiction, but he's best known for what could only sort of be characterized as theological thrillers. This series of novels that blended mystical Christianity with elements of the occult and set it in modern day England. I mean, these are weird, wild rides. But William's deep interest in esotericism and esoteric theology and the intersection of the spiritual and the physical worlds heavily influenced both his novels and his relationship with fellow Inklings. This is actually sort of controversial. His ideas especially left a lasting impact on Lewis, especially in how Lewis approached doing the themes of good, evil, and redemption in his own work. And Tolkien was not a big fan. Tolkien and Williams, I mean, there wasn't what I would say serious bad blood between them based on my research and what I've seen. However, they were, you know, Tolkien was not as fond of Williams as Lewis was, is how I'll say that. So, fascinating figure. His influence on Lewis is particularly clear in the novel That Hideous Strength, the third novel of the Space Trilogy. As mentioned, Williams had this unique way of blending theology and mysticism. He believed that spiritual truths could be expressed through mythology in a way that even transcends doctrine, that spiritual realities were embedded in the ordinary moments of life. For him, legends and myths were windows into this reality. That really resonated with Lewis, who saw the Christian faith, as we mentioned, as the fulfillment of the world's great myths. It aligned with Lewis's own beliefs that myths carry echoes, if you will, of Eden, or echoes of divine truth. So the Arthurian elements in That Hideous Strength, especially the inclusion of the character Merlin, serve as a way of connecting the ancient battle between good and evil to the modern world. It's this idea that spiritual warfare is not a new phenomenon, but something ancient, with its roots in legend. And it gives the story a sense of depth and continuity. The quest for truth, the quest for righteousness, it's a battle that every generation must fight, whether they realize it or not. And there's also, I wish we had time to get into this, there is also just a sort of forgotten, and I think it's forgotten simply because we're American. It's not even that we're Western. That so many of us are Americans. We really underestimate the influence that the Arthurian cycle had on a particular flavor of British fantasy writing. The Arthurian myth, King Arthur, the Holy Grail, Lancelot, Guinevere, all of these characters, Lady in the Lake, Excalibur, the Sword and Stone, all that stuff. The Arthurian myth, without getting into the historical roots and all that kind of stuff, developed in a very Christianized version of Europe. And so there is this inbuilt connection between the Arthurian myth and Christianity that has trickled its way into British fantasy from the very beginning. It really is underestimated. There is a sense in which a writer touching on Arthur, a writer touching on their own version of the Arthurian myth or incorporating Arthurian ideas into their own work, it is as part and parcel to fantasy writing as the great Lovecraftian mythos is to the cosmic horror genre. It's sort of a mark of, you know, it's grown so far beyond its roots that it's just part of the warp and woof of the genre and the culture in and of itself. And the Arthurian elements are just part and parcel to fantasy. They're almost inseparable. And what's interesting is that there is a clear Christian connection there, because the Arthurian myth as it developed maintained the Christian concepts, like the Holy Grail and what that is and that kind of a thing. So to have a work that connects in some way to Arthur, it's almost a it's a badge of honor, right? It's sort of a rite of passage in fantasy literature in some ways. And Lewis got there in that hideous strength by way of Charles Williams. That's the influence. You know, why are we in the third book of a space trilogy and Merlin shows up? I mean, it just seems like a very strange thing to do. And it threw a lot of people. It threw Tolkien himself. Tolkien wasn't as enthusiastic about Williams' work. He thought that Williams's mysticism was too esoteric and didn't fit comfortably within the boundaries of Christian orthodoxy. Tolkien would go as far as say that Charles Williams ruined Lewis's space trilogy because of what happened in that hideous strength. But it was Williams's influence that helped Lewis explore the intersection of myth and theology in ways that added a real richness to his storytelling. And the Arthurian connection complicates the apologetic narrative, but in a good way, because it forces readers to begin thinking about how spiritual truths, or just truths in general, manifest themselves across different cultures and times. And Lewis wanted to explore that, and that influence came as a result of Charles Williams.
So I do have an advantage over our listeners is that I've already read the article. So in your article, you compare C.S. Lewis' portrayal of the dangers of scientific hubris, really, to Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park, which is interesting. As I said at the top of this entire interview, we tend to think in modern day society that anything scientific is only good and should be really worshipped, and anything that is outside of that, spirituality, is people poo-poo that, right? And it kind of makes its way into this series. So how does Lewis's Christian perspective differentiate his critique of, you know, scientific hubris from other, let's say, secular narratives that you mentioned, like Michael Crichton and Jurassic Park?
So this idea of, we'll start a little broader and then we'll go narrow. In the broad sense, this is the idea of forbidden knowledge, right? Things like the myth of Prometheus warn against overreach, warn against human hubris. And this became especially important in modernity. I mean, Mary Shelley's book Frankenstein carries the subtitle The Modern Prometheus. And those two words, modern and Prometheus, are intentionally picked. They're put next to each other for a reason. This idea of the warning, right? Well, be careful of overreaching. Be careful of hubris. That's a mythic idea that you can trace right back to Eden, the forbidden knowledge, right? Don't overreach. Don't step outside the bounds. Don't do that. Those strands, because they are mythic, because they are there from the beginning, because they are just part of the warp and woof of storytelling, have worked their way into a lot of stories. I mean, you can count, you're going to run out of fingers and toes real fast about how many movies we watch that offer this, be careful with technology, sort of moral to the story, if you want to put it that way. I mean, think Terminator, think Jurassic Park. I mean, those stories are, in a sense, all about the Matrix, technology, AI, run amok, that kind of a thing. But what sets Lewis's critique apart is that he's not just warning about the unintended consequences of technology. He's warning about a spiritual problem. In that hideous strength, this group called NICE, N-I-C-E, the NICE isn't just a group of scientists making mistakes. They're actively engaged in a kind of rebellion against God. They want to reshape humanity and the world according to their own vision, with no regard for the divine order, which echoes the story of the Tower of Babel. It's the humans in active, willing rebellion against God. Attempting to elevate themselves to God's level, which, you know, comes back in the book of Revelation. It's always sort of that great question, that we get, well, you know, the events of Revelation, however you square that in your theology, when you know, Jesus is returning and things like that, are people not going to get clued into this? And, you know, how are people still going to rebel? I mean, the text is fairly clear. They're going to understand what's happening, and they actively choose to go against it. It's just like the Tower of Babel all over again. And Lewis is picking up on that here. Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park, absolutely iconic work, is more concerned with human arrogance and the unpredictability of complex systems, chaos theory. That's the character of Ian Malcolm, played by Jeff Goldblum. It's chaos theory, the unpredictability of complex systems. You're not going to be able to keep a lid on this. You're essentially opening Pandora's box. His message is more pragmatic. Just because we can do something doesn't mean we should. Lewis goes a step further. Lewis is going to say that when humans try to play God, they're not just making a practical mistake. They're committing a sin. He's not just saying, be careful with technology. He's saying, beware of the temptation to play God. For Lewis, the ultimate danger of scientific hubris isn't that we create something we can't control. It's in the process we lose our humanity. And that's what I think sets Lewis's critique of modernity over against a lot of the secular narratives we see today.
That is really fascinating. Just this discussion about works that were almost 100 years old yet have so much relevance.
Yeah, they almost seem prescient, right?
Some of the things that he suggests are almost like prophetic. Like, he was worried about these things in the 1930s and 40s, and they're just, yeah, that's what we deal with today. So Lewis critiques secular humanism for leading to moral relativism and, you know, empty spirituality, particularly in That Hideous Strength. So how can these critiques, just like we were saying, be used to address contemporary issues we have right now? Because, like I said, it still feels really relevant to what is going on in the world today.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, Tolkien's opinion aside, did Charles Williams ruin That Hideous Strength? In a way, That Hideous Strength is the most, as you're suggesting, you know, almost prophetic work that Lewis has. And I think that is actually due to the influence of Williams, because I think Williams was sort of ahead of his time, and he saw the world through slightly skewed eyes. That, you know, the best thing I can say about Charles Williams, just go read the guy's book. If you've never read Charles Williams, read the book Descent into Hell. A very good professor told me to read that book. I was having a particularly bad go of it in undergrad, and I was recommended the novel Descent into Hell. And I read it, and it sort of was like that same experience I've told you about of going to see the witch. It scours your soul, right? Descent into Hell really scours the soul, and with a brush, a really ruthless brush. And so if you don't know anything about Williams, you're never going to understand what I'm talking about unless you just go read the book itself. And so it was Williams' influence on That Hideous Strength that made Lewis's ideas so prescient, I would say. Lewis saw that when a society abandons belief in objective truth, it inevitably slides into moral relativism. And when there's no higher standard to define what's right or what's wrong, power becomes the only thing that matters. And, I don't think it takes a person with a PhD to listen to the narratives that are being spun and have been spun for the past 20 years. I mean, you know, I'm not going to talk politics, but like on my phone now, anytime I click on YouTube, because it is the year that it is and the time of year that it is, everything I see is a political ad. Everything I see is a political advertisement, muckraking, as they used to call it. The narrative is about power. Well, this person can't have power. This person can't have power. If this person has power, we're done. Power, 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 power. And you see it every time you turn around. When there's no higher standard to define right and wrong, power becomes the only thing that matters. The only thing people talk about. It's the only thing people care about. The cultural shift in this country that's taken place over the last half a century has everything to do with power, has everything to do with power plays, has everything to do with theories about how power is attained. All of the developments in social sciences and social studies, it's a hermeneutic of power in culture and in society. This is exactly what we see with the NICE and That Hideous Strength. They justify their actions, no matter how cruel or dehumanizing, because they believe they are advancing progress. It's a question of marching forward and power. And, you know, not being facetious about it, but really, morals be damned. Let's not have a moral discussion. Let's make it a conversation about power. Let's forget the question of who's right or wrong. Let's make it a question, or what's right or wrong, I should say. Let's forget what's right or wrong. Let's make it a conversation about who is holding the power here. Let's make it a conversation about rights rather than a conversation of morality, which I think you don't have to stretch very far to see the conversations relevant in this culture today that do exactly that. Lewis's critique of secular humanism speaks directly to the challenges we face today. We live in a culture where personal preference takes the place of objective truth, and where people are increasingly disconnected from any sense of higher purpose and are instead pointed toward connection with other people. As if, you know, it's sort of like if you ever spend any time in like a Bible school or anything like that, or if you just, you know, went to Sunday school, it's that old idea that, well, before your horizontal relationships can work out, you better get your vertical relationship clear first. As goofy as that, you know, old idea is, there's some merit to it. Lewis's work reminds us that without God and all that entails, we are left with a void that nothing else can fill, not science, not politics, and certainly not your personal freedom. So in those ways, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. Lewis, in large part, thanks to Williams, was absolutely prescient in what he's writing about, downright prophetic in some ways.
Well, it's really interesting that Lewis is blending of fiction with spiritual themes. You know, he has this universe where science and theology coexist. So that's really fascinating. So how does this integration help for the Christian apologist, really, convey Christian apologetic arguments in a way that if you just had a purely philosophical or a theological work like you were referencing at the beginning of this conversation might not offer?
Yeah, I think what Lewis does so brilliantly is show that theology isn't just about abstract concepts. It's about the fundamental realities of existence. By embedding theological truths within a science fiction framework, he's allowing readers to engage with those truths on an emotional and imaginative level. It's one thing to hear a theological argument about sin and redemption. We can do that all day long. It's another to experience it through the journey of a character like Ransom, to see it through another set of eyes. That kind of storytelling makes abstract ideas feel personal and real. And what makes Lewis's work so effective as apologetics is that it engages both the mind and the imagination. There's so much potential here. As people become more interested in spirituality and mythology, because that is where things are going. Let's be real clear on this. The Enlightenment Project failed. It failed in the 20th century. All of this marching forward in the good name of progress is also, you know, the century that decided to give us the atomic bomb. This is what, you know, anybody who saw Oppenheimer, I mean, it's kind of what this was about.
What I was going to say, it's really interesting you're talking about mythology and spirituality and people becoming more interested, like they wouldn't read the Bible, but they go to every superhero movie. It's kind of like the Star Wars universe. Like George Lucas used to employ a guy who almost was like the theologian of Star Wars. He had to track every single connection every single story or novel. And it's almost like people are approaching some of these mythologies, even if they're not Christians, like Tolkien, with this kind of searching for some spirituality or finding their religion in these universes. Marvel, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the trajectory of movies alone refutes the ideas that were absolutely critical to modern thought. I don't say modern like meaning right now. I say modern in the philosophical sense, modernity. That era, right? We would say that we're postmodern people, and we've talked about this before. I despise this term, postmodern. No, we're not. We're not postmodern. We haven't moved beyond modernity. Science is still the god of our age. We've moved beyond secularism, which walks hand in hand with modernity. We are still as empirical as ever. We want our facts. We want our evidence. We want that kind of stuff. What we've moved beyond is secularism. We've moved beyond the idea that was inherent to secularism and modernity, which said, in order for people to have progress, you have to jettison those old fogey ideas of spirituality, of religion, of mythology, those kinds of things. This is why when Gene Roddenberry created Star Trek, there were no gods, there were no religions in Star Trek, because at least initially, because the idea is that Gene Roddenberry was such a modern thinker that he thought, oh, well, in 150 years, we're not going to have religion. We're going to leave all that old stuff behind. Now, irony of ironies, there's religion in Star Trek. we talked about Strange New Worlds or Discovery at one point on this, very early on in this podcast, when I first started getting to know you guys. And, Christopher Pike, who is a wonderful, wonderful character in Star Trek, you know, his family, like his dad was a religious a scholar or something like that. And so these ideas of religion are now like, it's part of the characterizations, and they're things that people talk about in Star Trek. And it's like, look, this is so far from what Roddenberry at least envisioned initially. But what it does is it refutes that idea. It refutes that very idea that people are just going to leave this crap behind. No, that's not what happened at all. In fact, the superhero movie takes off. We run to our comic book stores. We get invested in these mythologies now and continuities and all that kind of stuff. So people become more interested in spirituality and mythology. What that means is that
people like they will believe in science and evolution and reject Christianity, yet they believe in fairies. You know, all kinds of other things. Like they will literally study Klingon.
Right. And you know, what's funny about this is there is a measure of inconsistency there. And I think this is the kind of thing that would drive the purely left brain systematic theologian crazy trying to do apologetics, because they're just constantly trying to follow someone's line of thought and it's constantly contradicting itself and they're tying themselves in knots trying to understand what people believe, because there really is a serious inconsistency to it. What that means though is that Christian apologetics has an extremely unique opportunity. And that would be my encouragement to the apologists, just my encouragement to people in general. Don't run from you can't even really call them atheists anymore, because you know, atheism was a very short-lived kind of boom for a period of time. If you go to the street, you know, we go through this with my students. If you go out on the street and you pull the average Tom, Dick, or Harry off the street and say, hey, what do you believe? The chances of you finding somebody who is able to marshal, based on modernistic thinking and empirical evidence, a reason for why there is no God, i.e. the atheist, is really slim. You're going to find, chances are, what we call an agnostic. Somebody who goes, I don't know. Maybe it's this, maybe it's that. Everybody's got a piece of the pie. Maybe nobody has a piece of the pie. I don't really know what to believe. That's more than likely what you're going to find. Don't run from that person. Don't run from that person. Because chances are that person, you know, based on the numbers, at least they were a couple of years ago, we're shelling out money to go to Endgame. A lot of money to go to Endgame. The Avengers film. Christian apologists have a real unique opportunity to engage with those interests. Lewis's approach shows us that storytelling, just stories, movies, books, can be a really powerful and effective tool for communicating the gospel. In fact, it may be the most powerful tool we've got. The themes he explores, sacrifice, redemption, battle between good and evil, all that stuff, resonate with people because they reflect the deepest truths of the human experience. And the Space Trilogy 100% offers a way into these conversations.
And I also think the Space Trilogy, there's probably for sure ideas that he brings up in his other classic works like Mere Christianity and some of his other nonfiction works, his philosophical work, and that could draw people into liking Lewis to maybe be open to reading Mere Christianity.
Absolutely. 110%. I would even say that, you know, a lot of people will characterize the Chronicles of Narnia as Lewis's, let's call it his
magnum opus.
Yeah. I actually am going to suggest that that work is Till We Have Faces, which is subtitled A Myth Retold. And it's easy to see why. I think Lewis himself probably even considered Till We Have Faces to be his most important work. It's this deeply personal, deeply philosophical retelling of the Cupid and Psyche myth, but with a twist. It's told from the perspective of Psyche's sister. And the story gets into themes like love, jealousy, faith, self-deception, all while grappling with the idea of what it means to know oneself and encounter the divine. And unlike his more straightforward fantasy and science fiction works, Till We Have Faces is far more introspective and layered. And it reflects Lewis's, because he writes it much later on, it reflects his mature thoughts on human nature and God. It's less overtly Christian than something like Chronicles of Narnia or the Space Trilogy. But the way he incorporates the maturity, the spiritual maturity, to call it that, makes it just stunningly powerful. And it is very nuanced. So I would even argue that, you know, more so than even the Space Trilogy or Narnia, Till We Have Faces is sort of the zenith of Lewis's, of all of these ideas that Lewis was writing about, put on paper and put out there for people to read. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right. These things can open doors.
Well, I was going to have a fun final question for Cole, but he already answered it, which was, what is your favorite Lewis?
Oh, Lewis work. Yeah.
You've already answered it. So that sounds like it's Till We Have Faces. So with that, thank you for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 418 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Cole Brigette, and he has written an online feature article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called Science, Spirituality, and C.S. Lewis, An Analysis of the Space Trilogy. And you can read his article for free without a paywall at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal, Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.